Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode here at the Damage Report. I'm John Arola. Big old Thursday, packed full of news for you. And we needed to come with someone equipped to handle all this news, which is unfortunately going to be a little bit dark. We are, after all, going to be talking about Curse of Cinema today. So we looked out there. We found someone indisputably equipped to do this. Dr. Rashad Ritchie joins us once again. How's it going, Rashad?
Man, it's going great, brother. Good to be with you, big homie. How you doing, man?
I'm doing okay. I'm doing eh. How are you doing? How's the news treating
you? I'm about the same. I think I'm a little bit above that, but not too far.
Mm-hmm. Well, you are obviously, you're having to manage all the work that you already do in a lot of different forms. And we are drawing ever closer with every passing day to the launch of the special 8-week run of Indisputable, the summer series, which is coming June 7th. That's a Monday, right after the Damage Report, 2:30 p.m. Eastern Time, 11:30 a.m. Pacific Time. It's going to be you, Dr. Rashad Ritchie, 8 weeks. How is the run up to the show going?
Man, I'm loving it. First of all, I could not ask for a better lead in than the Damage Report. All right, so let me first say that. We got a lot of great stuff, man. We got John Ossoff, US Senator. We got Killer Mike. We got some big surprises. And the format of the show will be pretty simple, right? We're gonna talk about news of the day. We're gonna talk about social issues, policy. We're also gonna talk about Karens. Okay, I got a segment called I Wish a Karen Would. Right, and we have our debates. We have our debates, our infamous debates, where I am continuing to get threats from people on the right, QAnon, etc. Because every time they send one of their guys to debate me, I send them back whimpering and crying and itching. Yeah,
that sounds awesome. I gotta see this Karen segment. That sounds awesome. I can see a lot of your face in the emojis in the chat. Fanzui in Twitch in all caps says 40 episodes of the doc. Who's pumped? And that's a nice. Good point. Like when you say 8 weeks, you think, oh God, I'm so excited. But it's this thing. It's like you can encapsulate it, 8 weeks. But that is 40 episodes. That is a significant undertaking. Yeah, now it seems overwhelming.
Thank you so much for that. It seems like I can't do that. Like that's a big number. Totally
done. You've done, I mean, how many hours of content have you done in your life? 40, drop of the bucket, come on. But a very exciting drop, and I know everyone's excited for it. Thank you everybody for being here, regardless of where you're at. If you're on Twitch, watching on the members, on YouTube, anything like that. Thank you for being here, really do appreciate your support. Please hit the like button, share the stream so the people know we're active. And as we go through, as we've demonstrated, we're gonna be keeping tabs on what you're all talking about. If you have any comments, questions, tweets, super chats, concerns, anything like that, you can send those to us and we'll respond as we go. I don't know what that comment in there. Anyway, okay, so with that though, Dr. Rashad Ritchie, are you ready to do this?
Let's kick it.
Okay, let's start off with a fun one. the face. Throughout this year, Curse of Cinema has joined Joe Manchin as one of the unfortunately most powerful people in the country, because in her guise as a Democrat in a 50-50 split Senate, her having, you know, whatever problem she wants with something, unfortunately might mean that it doesn't happen. Very often it has meant that it hasn't happened. And she's given this ever shifting defense of the filibuster that seems incredibly disconnected from the way that it's actually used, its history, and all of that. Well, she recently, along with Joe Manchin, said on the Capitol 6th Commission, that vote that we just had last week, this has to happen. We can find the good Republicans. We're gonna make this work, bipartisanship at its finest. And then they filibustered it and it didn't happen. And in fact, she didn't even participate in the vote. She was off somewhere. I don't know, maybe she was going to see an advanced screening of The Quiet Place 2. I don't know, nobody knows, she just wasn't there. So is that going to change her opinion on the filibuster? The fact that they once again filibustered this thing that she called an inexcusable thing to vote against. Well, here she is on the filibuster.
Well, as folks in Arizona know, I've long been a supporter of the filibuster because it is a tool that protects the democracy of our nation rather than allowing our country to ricochet wildly every 2 to 4 years back and forth between policies. The idea of the filibuster was created by those who came before us in the United States Senate to create comity and to encourage senators to find bipartisanship and work together. And while there are some who don't believe that bipartisanship is possible, I think that I'm a daily example that bipartisanship is possible. Not just this trip today and tomorrow that John and I are doing, but the work that John and I and many other of my colleagues in both parties do on a regular basis.
Okay, I have thoughts. But Dr. Rashad Ritchie, what do you think about that?
All right, so first of all, let me say that actually the majority of bills that are passed are bipartisan bills. We're not talking about bipartisan bills. We're talking about bills that have massive social and legal as well as economic impact. The big bills are not bipartisan. The big bills are the ones we pay attention to. The big bills are the ones where people will actually have a change of outcome in this country. And that's what's being ignored here. So she can keep talking this bipartisan malarkey. Let's be very clear about what she's really saying. She's saying that she wants to play politics so that she is politically safe on her home base, while at the same time acting as if she is a coalition builder. There is no coalition builder anymore. Trump got rid of that completely. The little bit that was left went out the door with Trump. It started to go out of the door with President Barack Obama because of the extreme hatred and racism they had toward him. And now the only thing that will save this nation and the only thing that will save the Democratic Party are progressives who are willing to hold everybody accountable to an agenda rather than a political partisan talking point.
Yeah. Yeah, and hold them accountable in a lot of different forms, up to it, including primarying senators who suck.
That is correct.
Like we're seeing right there, and I can't wait for that. So she said there, I'm an example of how bipartisanship can work. No, but like we're talking about like trying to get the most important bills passed, not this shallow, meaningless bipartisanship about things that don't matter. Like, yes, the Republicans will allow some bills to pass that don't challenge them or the status quo in any way. They'll do that, that's fine. But what does bipartisanship actually mean? Like she's like, and not just this trip with John Cornyn, who she didn't acknowledge, but participated in the filibuster of the January 6th commission. So that great, awesome guy that she gets along with literally blocked a vote from even occurring on an investigation into what she has described as this appalling attack against Capitol Police, and it left them dead. And how could you possibly, I don't know, don't tweet about it. Talk to your buddy when you're at lunch or whatever. You can turn to him, have him put down his sandwich briefly, and you can ask him why he filibusters that, and why he's gonna filibuster the Equality Act, and why he's gonna filibuster the For the People Act, and why he's gonna filibuster the infrastructure bill. Even if they compromise and compromise and compromise and tear it down to a tiny fraction of its current size, he will still work to filibuster it. So yeah, she will talk about like how, you know, bipartisanship is possible. He is laughing at her, maybe on the inside, often with his friends probably on the outside too, about that, because he knows it's not true. Fundamentally, she knows it's not true, Rashad. She's just gonna continue saying it as more and more of the time that Biden has slips by with very few accomplishments.
And that's why you gotta call people out like this who play games. See, they're playing games. Now they're playing games that have real world impact. And I also blame Democrats for not being able to properly message what the filibuster is. Its origin is from racism. Southern Democratic racists wanted the filibuster and used the filibuster in order to stop anti-lynching laws. I mean, it sounds like a good idea to get rid of lynching as something that we do legally in America. They used it to stop integration in the United States. They used the filibuster so that they could hold on to this white dominated white supremacy, et cetera, et cetera. That's what they did with it. Well, Democrats aren't willing to actually go on record in a messaging way. They have said it in silos, yes. But have they created an actual messaging campaign? No, because questions will arise, such as, well, wait a minute, Democrats did this. Or wait a minute, so-and-so who was a Democrat did this, or they supported this. Yep. You're going to have to deal with the demons of your own party if you want to tell the truth about the filibuster, message it properly and get sentiment on your side like never before, you're going to have to throw some Democrats under the bus to do it.
Yeah. Well, you're telling the truth about the filibuster. We're gonna do that too. And in fact, heads up to the director, if you could get ready with that third video, we're gonna skip around a little bit. But let's go into a little bit of the history that she, in a few minutes, is going to deny. So during the first half of the 20th century, Southern senators successfully blocked many efforts to pass anti-lynching legislation, including in 1922, 23, 24, 35. That year, the New York Times wrote, "One could hardly have witnessed the Senate scene this week and failed to notice the determination of the group of willful Southerners to prevent action." In 1938, Southern senators again shelved an anti-lynching bill with a 30-day filibuster. Some Senate, they shut down the federal government for a month to protect lynching. Some Republicans continue to filibuster legislation that would designate lynching as a federal hate crime, even now in 2020. Like, we can talk about the history of the filibuster, and we should, but let's also acknowledge it's still used in the same way. It was used to stymie civil rights. It was used to stop black people from having a substantive ability to vote historically. And by history, we mean 70 years ago, and we also mean 30 minutes ago. We mean last week. They're still doing it now. She knows that. She knows that that's the history of it. She knows that's what it's being used for right now. And she's going to pretend otherwise, as we'll see in a minute. But I wanted to give you a chance, Rashad, to comment.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And what we see are old tools being used in a new design. The tool itself is the same. And so the way you use it will be very similar. And we have seen it stop progress time and time again. Now, I also believe Joe Biden doesn't want to get rid of the filibuster. I don't believe Joe Biden will ever want to get rid of the filibuster because he's an institutionalist. He's gone on record about basically not having that as his focus. And I think he appreciates people like Joe Manchin and others who stand up for the filibuster. Well, here's the problem with that institutional background that Joe Biden has that he brings to the presidency. That is going to end up eating his leadership alive because he's leading in the 21st century, not in 1992. The whole idea of bipartisanship in this era is not the same. Remember, if you are for the idea that Donald Trump had the election stolen, and you are for the idea that Americans should have overturned the government in the insurrection, which by the way, the majority of Republicans do, we no longer have a partisan battle. We have a battle against those who are pro-America and those who are anti-America. The fact that you call yourself a patriot and a Republican should not matter to me. If you believe that you should overturn the country and you believe in a myth about the president or former president of the United States, you're not even for the country that you live in.
Yeah, it's nonsense. We're gonna turn to her comments about Jim Crow in a bit, but like it's like, I don't know, it makes me think of like a terrible abusive relationship where like finally the guy gets kicked out, but you still give him the ability to like veto her future relationships, her career changes, she can't move if he doesn't let her. Like, wait, why? Why is he still in control when he's not in control? But that is what she is willingly giving to the Republicans. Her and Manchin have decided, and they'll say, you know, oh, it's designed so there aren't like huge changes, you know, from like one administration to the other, which that doesn't exist. It's not a true concern. What they're concerned about is actual working people ever having power. They want consistency of, sure, sometimes Democrats, sometimes Republicans, but nothing big will ever be done to challenge those with power and those with money. Anyway, here is what she has to say when she is challenged about the dark history of the filibuster.
A lot of us say that the filibuster is a relic of the Jim Crow era. And my sense is you don't support those things from the Jim Crow era, so why would you support the filibuster?
Well, the filibuster was not created as a tool to accomplish one thing or another. It was created as a tool to bring together members of different parties to find compromise and coalition. It was designed to be a place where you cooled the passions of the House, where you work together to find that compromise, and importantly, where you protect the rights of the minority from the majority, regardless of which party is in the majority at the time.
Now, so a lot of what she said is ahistorical nonsense. It was used like 50% of the time for the first 50 years of its use was to stop civil rights legislation. So it definitely was a tool designed for that. However, there is a bit of truth in what she says at the end, which is it's meant to protect the rights of the minority regardless of which party is in power. And people use that without really defining the terms to make it seem like, well, you know, now you'd like your side to use power, but like what about the next time? The minority, we're talking politically. No, it's the wealthy. The wealthy will be protected no matter who is in power. So if like the even more blatantly corrupt and pro-corporate Republicans are in power, then they'll give tax cuts to the rich and to corporations and they'll stop anything else from happening. And if like the people get so fed up with it that they finally get through all the voter suppression and the way the Senate is fundamentally unrepresentative and the Electoral College and all that, that they get the Democrats in power, then even if some of the Democrats are willing to change a policy, and far too few of them will, doesn't matter. Republicans are still in power. As long as they can maintain just a little bit of popular support, they will be able to control basically everything. In fact, I saw the Brennan Center for Justice has a projection by 2040, given projected population growth, 2/3 of Americans will be represented by just 30% of the Senate.
Wow.
So it is becoming more difficult, more monumentally impossible for the people, even if they can work through all of these legal changes to make their vote not count, to ever have enough political power to just have a majority, let alone 60%. The filibuster is seeming like insult to injury at this point because we can't even get 50% to actually support anything that's gonna benefit working people.
Yeah, what are they afraid of? For those who believe that somehow getting rid of the filibuster creates this potential world in the future where Republicans can take over and then simply unravel what you've done. Well, hell, that's politics. That's how it actually works. But if you get in and do a good job, if you do the job that you were paid to do, elected to do, why would the American people vote you out of that position? So what are you afraid of? You're afraid of 50% plus one? You're scared of that? That's called democracy. If you are afraid of a simple majority in any formation, that means you signed up for the wrong job. You are afraid of actual democracy. And all of this, well, what may happen in the future? Well, yeah, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about securing the future. We're talking about having an agenda that is so powerful and so dynamic that it impacts American citizens in a way where they actually see you doing your job and you get it done. And because of that, you can retain power. How do you retain power in democracy? Not by negotiation, but by doing a damn good job and people voting you back in. That's democracy.
Yeah, in theory, it sounds good. I'd love to experience it at some point.
Yeah.
In reference to something she said though, I have a question for Kyrsten Sinema and every person who says the filibuster is designed to bring both sides together. It's about comedy, about coming together and working together. Okay, so why doesn't that ever work? Like on anything important, on anything substantive, why can you keep saying that, being proven wrong, like the other side laughing in your face as your stupid ahistorical take on the filibuster is proven laughably wrong over and over again? Why doesn't it ever have to actually work for you to keep saying that? Like you just say it anyway. Why would it work? Why would the filibuster bring both sides together? There's a very basic requirement for her and other people's hypothesis to actually work. And that would be for both sides to want something. If both sides wanted something, then in theory, the Republicans would have to come and work with the group in power to get what they want. But what they want is nothing. They want nothing to happen. They want taxes to stay where they're at, you know, until they can get back in power and lower them. They don't want money spent on things. Like, you think they want influence over the infrastructure bill? They don't give a damn if there's never an infrastructure bill. They had power for years and didn't pass one. You think they want a revamping of immigration law under a Democratic administration? Why would they want that? Like some big change to healthcare or free public college? Oh yeah, they just want influence. No, they don't want that to happen. And in that area, they don't need to come together because they have ultimate control. They can stop anything at any time. Yeah. So the filibuster is not creating an incentive for them to come together. It is assuring them that they never have to. Now, if you got rid of it, then they would have to come together to have some influence over the process. It might not be much influence. It arguably shouldn't be since they keep losing national elections over and over and over again. But they would have to have a seat at the table. Now they get to turn the table over anytime they want. It is such a, and like, it's so pointless to even say this. Kyrsten Sinema knows every single word that we're saying now. She doesn't believe anything that she's saying. But I think it's very important that other people do, so that if they hear regular good people out who believe, well, you know, yeah, they do filibuster a lot, but in theory it'll lead to bipartisanship. No, it's not designed to do that. It doesn't do that. In fact, it assures that there never will be substantive bipartisanship.
That's right. That's right. And one of the things that would happen, and I think we need to really highlight the point you just made. You go to a simple majority, you still have moderate Democrats in the Senate. You still got to work to get their votes. And also watch what happens if you go to a simple majority. Republicans could technically serve an entire term or an entire 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, and never get anything done. Never actually vote to promote something. So when their reelection comes up in 6 years, they can always say, well, I didn't get anything done. And Democrats can run on that and say, this guy literally did not pass one bill nor support one bill. Or the other way it happened, John, where the Republican needs to be able to say, I got something done for the people in my state. And if Democrats have the simple majority, and you've negotiated a bill where that simple majority can push legislation, I may need to get on board with this simple majority because my people will benefit in my state. If I'm on record for not voting for this and my people are saying they celebrate the policy, I have a political problem.
Yeah. Yeah, and if the Democrats were passing things, then in theory, the Republicans might feel some pressure to come up with alternatives to campaign on. It might lead to them actually campaigning on policy. Now, they filibuster everything, nothing gets done. There's no alternative needed. If they could just block everything the Democrats do, they never have to pass anything. And as I already laid out, they don't want to pass anything. Like you, as Anna and I were talking about this with Tucker Carlson last night, you can't expect solutions from people for whom they see no problems. They're fat and happy. They're wealthy beyond your most like fantastical dreams. Everything's okay. All the problems we talk about on a daily basis on this show, come up with any problem you want, don't affect them because they are shrouded in armor composed of millions and millions of dollars. What the Democrats desperately needed was another thing stopping them from getting literally anything done. And hey, the universe has delivered with Senate parliamentarian Elizabeth McDonough effectively ruling that only one more automatic budget reconciliation is permissible this year, dealing a blow to Democrats who previously thought they would have two more chances to sidestep Republicans in advancing President Biden's agenda. McDonough ruled that a revision to the 2021 budget resolution cannot be automatically discharged from the Senate Budget Committee, meaning Democrats would need at least one Republican on the 11-11 panel to vote with them. Well, that's being pitched as something difficult. There's good Republicans. Bipartisanship and all that. Surely one reasonable Republican will work with them. Look, it gets even more wonky and specific to budget committee, blah, blah procedure after that. What you need to know is the parliamentarian, who there is no good reason for us to even know what this individual's name is saying this. It doesn't necessarily mean anything, but it's feeling like the Democrats are going to treat it as if it's the word of God, Rashad.
Yep, and they did this last time. So let me break down who the parliamentarian is. This person does not exist by way of constitutional mandate. This person does not exist by way of statutory mandate. This is a Senate rule. That's what it is. If you've been to a board meeting, you know that there's typically a parliamentarian who is a counsel for the rules. They don't enforce nothing. The parliamentarian has no executive authority. The parliamentarian is a counselor and exists as a person who can give you guidance to the rule. So let's look at this as an office rule. Let's say that for the sake of argument. This office rule, by way of Senate rules, can in fact be ignored by the Vice President of the United States. It has happened before. It is rare, but it has taken place. There's precedent. But nobody's talking about the other side of that. I don't hear Democrats going on CNN or anywhere else saying, hey, you know, the Vice President can actually, per Senate rules, overrule the parliamentarian. Once again, you're not outside of the context of the rules. It's inside of the rules that the Vice President can overrule. Why aren't Democrats talking about this at all?
Yeah, why aren't seemingly any of them bothered by the, at every turn, proof that they're not gonna get anything done? Like, why Schumer doesn't seem that frustrated?
Schumer Harris, trying to raise money on YouTube, man.
That's true. Oh God. What about the Vice President? Like, this, we're directly talking about something you can get involved in. Where are you? Like, I don't. Maybe she's being ordered by Biden not to say anything. I don't know. That begs the question, Biden. Why aren't you bothered by this, man? You've been trying to become president for 300 years now, and they're going to stop you from doing anything. And like, I don't know. Maybe it's the parliamentarian. Maybe it's Kirsten Sinema. Maybe it's Joe Manchin. I don't know. There's a bunch of them who are saying you're not going to get anything done, and it doesn't really seem to bother you that much. And like, I get it. Joe Biden can always fall back on the fact that he's already president. Well, Kamala Harris, I know that you are just itching to run for president. You don't think that a track record of getting like nothing done is gonna hurt your chances? You don't think that's gonna make it a little bit easier for a progressive to beat you in the primary? If you could have stepped in over and over and you choose not to, and we cruise the next 4 years only having passed that pandemic bill and that's basically it. They're gonna block you from getting a Supreme Court justice. If Breyer actually does step down, they're gonna do everything they can to block it. Are they just gonna roll over, the Democrats, and just have an 8-person Supreme Court for the next few years? And they're gonna try to go into a primary saying, this is our record. I stand by it. Why aren't you mad? Why aren't you frustrated by this? Why aren't you doing literally anything? And this is an open question to basically any elected Democrat. Why aren't you doing anything?
Yeah. Or at least saying all of the options that can be done. I would respect it even more if Democrats would just go on record and say, right, the parliamentarian has made this ruling. That ruling is not an executive action. That ruling is in fact a guidance. That guidance can be ignored by the Vice President of the United States per Senate rules. I would be fine if one Democrat just went on record and said what it is. But you're right, people are taking orders. I almost feel like we got 5 or 6 presidents. I feel like we got President Joe Manchin. I feel like Biden's in there somewhere. Kamala Harris, the Vice President, is in the background, right? That's how I feel. And what happens is you have this gridlock of leadership. The reason why we have a hierarchy of leadership is because in the design of this country, we wanted someone not only to be in charge, but to also be accountable. So you can't keep saying that you're the guy in charge, but you're not accountable for when things don't happen or things don't get executed. Yeah. And this is the irony of it all, John. Literally, Republicans are pulling all of these strings. Trump is behind the Republicans pulling these strings. And come midterm election, you know who will get blamed for doing nothing? The Democrats who actually are in power.
Yeah. And look, you know, if right now the Vice President is like, really like hesitant to use her power, like, should I do it? Well, don't worry about it for that much longer, because soon you won't have it. You won't be breaking any ties when the Republicans have majority by a couple seats. And I'll say this again, I apologize for the constant repetition of this, but it has to be pointed out. Like, there is no more important lens, I think, to view American politics or just America generally than the outcomes of inequality. And in this case, political inequality. There are all of these failure points in our, I view them as failure points in our government where action can be stopped. And you might think, oh, well, that's built in, but everybody has to try to manage it. Because if you can't get your agenda done, then that hurts all sides equally. It hurts the Democrats when they're in power, hurts the Republicans when they're in power. No, that's not how it works at all. Not being able to get anything done hurts the side that needs to get stuff done. But when you're fat and happy and rich and powerful and everything is set up to benefit you, you don't have to get anything done. There, failures to get something done, that's just a great stalling tactic. And it wards off, you know, popular concern for why Republican presidents literally never do anything. It is just, it is not equal. That is why these things need to be fixed. They cannot just abide and sometimes it hurts us, sometimes it hurts them. No, it hurts the working people all the time, the rich people never. That's how it works.
Man, you hit a grand slam, brother, because you're right. anytime you hear a politician talk about, well, if we do this, the opposition party is going to do that. Well, you have left the individuals who are absolutely impacted all the time out of your entire whataboutism. But it shows you a glimpse of their soul. It shows you where they are in their thinking about how their leadership should roll. And that's why the best way to change a system is to replace the people who implement the system. That's the way to do it. We can keep trying to change the mind of these politicians, but the way to really get reform is to change out the actors who are in charge.
Yeah, you're right. And it's really slow and it's really frustrating, but it might be the only way. Okay, really fast, let's move into, oh my God, what happens when the government actually does do something? We don't often get to talk about this. Over the course of the past year, 15 months or so, there have been a couple of rounds of stimulus checks, the survival bill checks that have gone out. And what effect did those actually have in this rare instance where the federal government actually uses the money that people have paid into it to benefit those people who are hurting? Well, a new analysis of Census Bureau surveys argues that the two latest rounds of aid significantly improved Americans' ability to buy food, pay household bills, and reduced anxiety and depression, with the largest benefits going to the poorest households and those with children. Among households with children, food shortages fell 42%, financial instability fell 43%. Among all households, frequent anxiety and depression fell by more than 20%. And all of that was bought with a little bit of money that we throw away in tax cuts every single time a Republican gets inaugurated. And we're always told it'll trickle down and it'll benefit the people at the bottom. Well, radical idea, what if you just gave those people the money directly? What if those are the ones that actually benefit and it didn't have to filter through the whims and fancies of a bunch of political elites? Well, so Rashad, it's, these are not final. There are other things that could potentially be affected this, but it looks like those survival payments actually had the effect that it was hypothesized they would.
It worked. It would have worked better if we didn't have to compromise it. And that's the lesson in this. Yes, it worked, but there was a plan put on the table by progressives that did even more. So we could be talking about a much higher number of people who are helped by these programs. So I'm glad that people are helped. I'm glad that the program shows that it actually does work when you implement it, execute it the right way. Government has its place, and this is one of them. You pay into a taxation system, you're supposed to use that money to help people when they are in need. But remember, we still spend more money to kill people and blow things up. We would never argue over going to war. Have you ever heard somebody on the Senate floor say, John, you know, it would be a great idea to go to war with Iran this year, but we don't have it in the budget. We always have unlimited money to kill people and blow things up. Don't you find that amazing? And then we pitch pennies. We pinch them when it comes to, let's say, Meals on Wheels, right? We don't have enough money for that. Historically black colleges and universities completely tapped out. But if you're talking about bombing a brown country, we got excess of funding for that.
Yeah, it's just like imagine, like we're in week two of the coverage of the negotiations to see if they can scrape together enough money to continue blowing the hell out of Yemen. Right. And then, oh, nope, they've come out of the room. They just couldn't make it work. I guess the war's off, everyone. Right. Like imagine if that happened. What if, like, how is it not that like you have to fill all your other obligations and then the money left over, you can put it into bombs or whatever. Like it's not like that at all. Like you don't. I like wasting money as much as any American, but the bills and like your food have to come first generally. It can't all go into like cosmetic skins for League of Legends. That comes after, okay? Okay, so let's check in on QAnon and what people think about it. And this matters. We're gonna give you the results of a study of what different demographic groups think about the absolutely insane theories of these QAnon people. But bear in mind, already, in the 22-22 congressional cycle, there are 19 declared QAnon candidates for office. Isn't that fun? There were way more in 2020, and there's a lot of time. We'll probably break records. And this is not like delving deep into their forum post to try to find some indication. No, they're just putting hashtag when we go one, we go all in their comments and stuff like that. It is open QAnon stuff. Well, what country are they running in? What will the American people think? Well, at large, depending on how you word it, and it's pretty conspiratorial stuff. They're not trying to trick people into answering this. Like if you ask people, the government, media, and financial worlds in the US are controlled by a group of Satan worshiping pedophiles who run a global child sex trafficking operation. One of the core elements of the QAnon thing. 15% of all Americans are like, yeah, no, that's true. That's a thing that's true. 23% of Republicans, hell, 8% of Democrats believe that at large. And you can get different numbers if you word it differently, like there is a storm coming soon that will sweep away the elites in power and restore the rightful leaders, that sort of nonsense. 28% of Republicans believe that. Fully 1 in 5 of all Americans believe, oh, you know, everybody that I don't like in politics and entertainment, they're going to be swept away. You're going to have no more Biden, no more Chrissy Teigen. It's all coming up me, thanks to the storm that's coming. And we've got a lot more that's going to break this down. Including that last bit on there about violence. But Dr. Rashad, what do you think about this? 25%, something like that, thinking that this is true.
Yeah, and that number is going to increase. And here's the problem with indoctrination. Indoctrination is exactly what you're reading. These individuals have been told a lie. But it's not just the lie. Indoctrination never works when you just do it one time. Indoctrination works by repetition. So how was repetition used? Twitter, Facebook, whatever. The 24-hour news cycle of Fox News. This repetition allows an individual to consume all of their information from one source. Now it looks like different platforms, but it's one source. It's one message. And they have now started to believe the message. It's not a coincidence that last year, the number of QAnon conspiracy theorists was lower than it is this year. It means that the indoctrination has continued and more people are believing the madness. And we have seen it now on a mass scale. And at some point in the future, this is going to be a great case study for mass psychology.
Yeah. Well, and in the meantime, what's going to happen as a result of these beliefs? Because, you know, like, on some level, I think simply believing that like Satanists are in charge everywhere is problem enough. But what could that actually produce? Well, bad stuff. Because when you ask the American people, because things have gotten so far off track, true American patriots may have to resort to violence in order to save our country. 15% of all Americans are like, yes, that is true. 28% of all Republicans believe that it might be true. Some independents and even 7% of Democrats believe violence may be necessary because things have gotten off track. Now, they don't necessarily believe that they've gotten off track because of the global cabal of Satanists or whatever. But close to 1 in 3 of all Republicans believe, maybe not me, maybe I won't do it, but I don't know, somebody might need to use violence. And I guarantee that's an underestimate. If it, I mean, first of all, we don't have to say if it happened, they tried it on the 6th, and you can already see that the majority of Republicans are perfectly fine with it. They may not storm the barricades, but they're totally cool with those who do. And you know, a few people died, they didn't kill any politicians. It's all speculation as to what Republicans would think if they had. But I personally don't think that if they had literally managed to get Mike Pence to those gallows and had hung him there, I don't think Tucker Carlson would disavow everything that he's been saying and turn over a new leaf. I don't think that most Republicans would be like, oh my God, we've gone too far. All this Trump stuff, this QAnon, we really do need to turn a new direction. I don't think so. I think that their ability to forgive and apologize for literally anything, the worst violent excesses, I think we have not even begun to reach the limits of that.
Yeah, and this is what happens when you get your news from Alex Jones. You create these individuals. I always question the idea of what's happening now in America being the absolute worst thing that has ever happened. Because you have a lot of Republicans who say that the country has been being taken away, that the morality of the country is falling. And then they'll cite things like the LGBTQ community as a way that morality is somehow questionable in the United States of America or somehow falling apart. Did they forget that they used to own people? And they could own those people kill them, rape them, beat them, molest them without repercussion from the government. I would say that's actually the darkest history in the United States of America. And if you don't believe that that was the darkest hour of this country, everything you say is bull to me.
You know, I don't know why I've never put those two things together. And like obviously QAnon is national thing, but it's more common in more conservative areas. Mm-hmm. Like they deny that that was bad at all.
Right.
That when there was a political cable, as Marjorie Greene would say, of people human trafficking, sex trafficking, breaking up families, selling people, they don't like care about that at all.
No.
But they don't talk about it. Fictional version really bothers them right now.
Mm-hmm. They do not talk about it in that context. Point. But slavery was also child sex trafficking. Slavery was also child molestation. And they don't, they somehow forget, or they willfully forget the darkness of this country, the real darkness of the country.
Yeah, you're 100% right. Here is a story that I think rightfully opened some people's eyes about this insane racist practice that just now is ending. And it comes to us via the NFL, which announced yesterday that they've pledged to halt the use of race norming, which assumed black players started out with lower cognitive function, in a $1 billion settlement of brain injury claims and to review past scores for any potential race bias. You know what? I'm going to make a bold prediction. I think they're going to find some. In its use of race norming, the league compares a given player's cognitive test scores with the supposed norm of his demographic group. Under the methodology, black players are assumed to possess a lower level of cognitive function than the average white player. So in theory, if your brain is damaged, in the way that it's been shown that years of playing football can do, if they pretend that you started at a lower cognitive level, then a massive decline from those injuries would read as no decline at all or a smaller one. And that is madness, Dr. Rashad. Like, I guess, look, I shouldn't, put anything past America or wealthy corporations, but the fact that that was going on up until yesterday is insane.
That sounds like some mad scientist stuff, man. Like, this was real and this was considered to be legitimate in the application of how we determine who should receive, compensation because of what the NFL has done to brutally injure individuals. That's amazing to me. But once again, for those who are still denying that systemic racism exists, here's another example. You don't get more clearer of a systemic racism issue than literally saying, yeah, we're a major, major multi-billion dollar corporation. And by the way, we believe black people are inherently dumber than white folks.
Yeah. Yeah, and look, part of it, I'm sure, is that they don't want to give any player a single dollar in compensation for the injuries they've sustained. But racism is a particularly reliable and predictable fallback for that. Now, they, and Dr. Rashad there was talking about, like, it doesn't get any more systemic than this. Even their defense of it proves that point. The NFL has defended the practice in the past, saying its standards, quote, relied on widely accepted and long established cognitive tests and scoring methodologies. I bet they did.
Right.
On long established, widely accepted, racist cognitive assessments or predictions. Like, yeah, I'm sure lots of people have been racist for a long time, and lots of other racist people widely accepted that racism. Like, that is not an actual defense. It is amazing that it took this long. I'm glad that it's finally changing, and that there might be some, ability to go back and correct, if you did not get a settlement. And very few did, by the way. More than 2,000 former NFL players have lodged dementia claims as a result of their injuries, but fewer than 600 have received compensation. And so with lawyers saying that more than half of NFL retirees are black, and so few receiving any money at all, and the money they're receiving probably lower because of this race norming practice, this is a massive injustice affecting hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people. And so it's good to see at least some change.
Yeah, and cognitive tests are always implicitly biased. As a college professor, I use something in the classroom called differentiated education. That's when I look at different elements to help a student understand the curriculum. One, cognitive thinking. Two, relational thinking. What I have found is that some individuals who learn, they learn better when you make the relationship connect to the curriculum. There are other students who learn better when you make a cognitive analysis of the material. That just has to do with learning style. Learning ability is not the same as learning style. And these cognitive tests, what they have tested is learning style and interpreted it as learning ability.
Yeah, it's actual, like what you're describing is in setting up a system, it, like this might be charitable, is ignorant about the way that people learn, and their ignorance is thus producing the mirage of ignorance on the people being actually tested.
That is correct.
To some extent, I'm not sure that it is 100% ignorance. It's very convenient. So maybe it's intentional, but yeah, you're so right. People learn in different ways, and the tests need to reflect that. And they basically never do. And this is one great example of it, but obviously this affects millions and millions of people when it comes to standardized testing and things like that as well.
Yeah, and in this case, it actually affects people getting the money they deserve.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, let's move on to our last topic for the day, something we haven't often talked about, and I can't wait to see what happens in my DMs after this. Don't at me, honestly. We're gonna talk about it, but then I don't wanna talk about it anymore after that, but we're gonna turn to this now. 2021 has seen the rise of NFTs. These are the non-fungible tokens called crypto collectibles. They come in a lot of different forms, but they exploded in popularity earlier this year. A video clip that was created by digital artist Beeple, whose real name is Mike Winkleman, was flipped to a record $6.6 million last week. It had originally been bought for around $67,000. By the way, this, what I'm referencing is from earlier this year. So this was one of the first big sales of an NFT. And you might not have been paying much attention this year. You might be wondering, what are NFTs? Well, look, partially it's complicated, and also you might not need to know it for much longer. But basically it's digital, like verifiable one owner images or memes or videos. And that might strike you as on its face kind of stupid. I'm with you, buddy. I know I'm an idiot. I don't get any of this stuff. But anyway, back at that time earlier this year, one of thousands of computer generated avatars called CryptoPunks sold for $2 million. A crypto art rendition of the Neon Cat meme from 2011 sold for $590,000 at an online auction. A meme for $590,000. Well, so why? Why did this blow up? Well, there was a lot of conversation about this. There were some pros and some cons, advocates and people who were against it. Proponents say that they fix a big problem with the internet, which is artists not getting paid for the distribution of their content online. Seems like a totally legitimate concern. At the same time, critics see the NFT craze as another potential speculative frenzy in crypto that's sure to fizzle out eventually. That was earlier this year. Well, the fizzling seems to have come, because NFTs apparently peaked on May 3rd when $102 million worth of memes and paintings and songs and stuff were sold in a single day. The crypto collectibles market made up $100 million of those sales. Overall, $170 million in NFTs were transacted in just 7 days. Now that was at the beginning of last month. According to data analyzed by Protos, just $19.4 million in NFT sales were processed in the past week, which means that they declined by somewhere around 90% over the course of 1 month. We have other stats. Dr. Rashad, we've never talked about NFTs before. Obviously, I'm a little bit biased against this sort of thing, but what are your thoughts about it?
Somebody got rich. I don't know much about it, man. I remember when it first came out, it was a craze. People were excited about it, and you know, it looked good, right? I mean, it had this upward trajectory. And I keep things simple, man. I invest in simple things. I do have some rules to investment, like I don't invest in prisons. I won't invest in companies that won't hire those that have been incarcerated before. So I have these rules. So I keep things really simple. When there's this, it's not just cryptocurrency. And that's the thing that makes it even more confusing, because cryptocurrency is already kind of confusing. It's different than that. It's like an added layer of something else in the cryptocurrency market. So because it was hella confusing to me, I never got involved in it. But I just tell people, man, you get what you pay for, buy your beware, make sure you research and follow the market, because if you took your money out before May 3rd, you may have been okay.
Yeah, yeah, some people definitely made money. I mean, whoever it is that was able to sell the neon cat, they got their money's worth for that image of a cat, I think. You know, they got several Ferraris for that cat picture. Anyway, look, what I'm mostly talking about here, what the analysis is mostly talking about, and my frustration is about the, I think, objectively outsized payments for specific things. Not the fundamental idea that there should be some sort of verifiable ownership of digital content. Mm-hmm. That's fine, and that will exist for, I would guess, 99.9% of artists and song makers and meme makers and that sort of thing. They're not going to be making millions of dollars for their thing. And long after this speculative bubble has burst, hopefully they'll have a technology that they can use. And if that leads to more people getting paid for their content, that's a good thing. But this is madness. This is like some of the stuff we've seen with stocks, some of the stuff we've seen with cryptocurrency. This is people desperate to get rich off of the perception that people can get rich.
Yeah.
And so they say that it can happen so that other people can believe that it'll happen. It is a self-fulfilling financial prophecy that for some will result in them getting rich. There are people who have made it big off of cryptocurrency. There are people who made it big off of NFTs. But every dollar they've gotten will be funded by people who will not get rich off of it. And best case scenario, they end up with a picture of a cat. Some people will not even have the picture of a cat. They're just gonna lose everything when these bubbles burst.
It's kind of like Herbalife.
Yeah, yeah, but at least in that case, you get herbs, right? Or juice, right, I don't know, what do they sell?
You can't sell something. It, but you got something in the garage.
Exactly, you got a big box of something juicy, I don't know. Anyway, so we'll see, maybe it'll come back. And there are still some subcategories of NFTs that are doing okay. But the massive like frenzy, people were like just looking around their hard drives to find something to label for $1 million and selling it. That might have died off for a little while, but we'll see. Anyway, Dr. Rashad Ritchie, that is unfortunately all the time we have, but thank you so much for joining us. As always, it's always a pleasure to have you on. We began the show talking a little bit about Indisputable. It's still a little bit off. It's less than a week at this point, right? We're just a few days away. So you want to give people a pitch to get them excited for the launch of the show next week?
Absolutely. So we launch June 7th, 2:30 p.m. Eastern time, 11:30 a.m. Pacific time. Make sure you join us. We got a lot of hot stuff. But do me a big favor. I want you to join the YouTube page to become a subscriber on that YouTube page. You can go to youtube.com/indisputabletyt. Indisputable TYT, make sure you subscribe, hit that bell. Appreciate you, man.
No, anytime. And very excited to see the launch of the show.
Thank you, brother.
Have a good one. Here's something that you might not know. In the United States, you can be an elected representative in Congress, and you could be having committee meetings, meeting with lobbyists, passing legislation that affects different segments of the economy. And you can be buying and selling stocks that will be directly and predictably affected by your actions or inactions. Is that crazy? That literally is totally legal. There's nothing wrong with it. And most people don't even know about it, let alone talk about it or make political decisions based on it. But that might be changing. There have been some little attempts in the background in the last few years to possibly change that legal situation. And we have a new one coming. And joining us now to break it down is a senior Washington correspondent for Insider, returning once again, Dave Leventhal. Thank you as always for being here.
Hey, great to be with you, John.
Great to have you here. So Senator Elizabeth Warren wants to do something about stock ownership, right?
She sure does. She wants to get rid of it. She wants to ban it for members of Congress. So effectively, if you're a senator, if you're a member of the House, and you own individual stocks, might be an AT&T, might be an ExxonMobil, she wants to prevent you from doing that. Now, she says that, hey, it's okay if you want to have a mutual fund or some index-traded fund, that's okay. But if you are, in fact, a member of Congress, and you are going to those committee hearings that may have some sort of an effect on the way that business is conducted in the country, the way that businesses are taxed, the way that the government interacts with businesses, and that this should not be happening. And also, too, she wants to apply that not only to members of Congress, but apply that to other top officials, the President of the United States, top judicial officials, and so on and so forth.
Okay, and so this is not the first time, you know, based on your analysis, she's actually advanced legislation similar to this in past years, correct?
She has. So you have to go back 10 years, John, to when the Stock Act became law. And what the Stock Act was originally intended to do was to do exactly this: ban members of Congress from being able to buy and sell and trade individual stocks of companies that do business with the government, that come before Congress, might even be government contractors, wanted to get rid of it. But the bill got watered down, as these things oftentimes do in Washington, D.C. And ultimately, the bill did lots of things, but one of the most important things is it said, all right, we're not going to ban this practice, but you have to disclose your activity publicly. If you buy stock, if you sell it, you're going to have to tell the public that you've done that, and do so in a relatively quick period of time. Now, that is often worked out, but not always. We've done a lot of reporting around the issue of members of Congress just simply not disclosing when they should. And Elizabeth Warren, over the past couple of congressional sessions, has advanced legislation, although it's gone nowhere, to try to ban the practice of stocks. What's different this time is that Democrats control the Senate, and Democrats control all of Congress. So the possibility of this legislation going forward to a degree, to a point beyond where it had in the past, is much higher than it was if we were having this conversation even a year ago.
Okay, so she's tried in the past and has failed. How much support have those past efforts, you know, obviously they weren't successful, but those past efforts, has she had a lot of Democrats sign on as co-sponsors or otherwise show support for this legislation?
In a shocking development, no, she has not. I mean, this is like two sports teams coming onto the field and there are no referees there. So the two teams look at each other and say, oh, all right, we'll call our own fouls. Well, what are they probably going to do? They're probably going to call as few fouls as they possibly can, knowing full well that if they start, you know, beating up on the other team will have the ability to beat up on them. So in a way, there's sort of this detente in Congress where neither the Republicans nor the Democrats really seem particularly eager to do something that could result in self-harm, if you will. But Elizabeth Warren is trying to break through all that and say, no, this, in her opinion, is the right thing to do. It's the ethical thing to do. And she would very much like to see this happen, even if she's not exactly getting members of Congress to line up to co-sponsor this legislation or otherwise support it straight up.
Yeah. I have more questions, but let's just pause for a second and acknowledge that expecting them to take an action that would stop them from doing unethical things to personally enrich themselves seems like just one of those absurd wrinkles of American representative government, like that we would expect that they would, well, they would obviously rise above their own personal financial concerns and do this. It seems crazy. It seems like the sort of thing that if it were to ever happen would only come in the form of some sort of constitutional amendment. But there have been other Democrats who have expressed interest in this. I mean, I don't know if you've personally reported on it, but I feel like Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez often talked, especially during last year, where Senators Perdue and Loeffler were like they weren't even trying to hide it, as representatives do, the linking up of the sync of their financial decisions and what was going on in the country. Has there been any signs that this most recent effort by Senator Warren might have more Democrats sign on as co-sponsors or supporters?
Yes, I should note that although there hasn't been many people lining up on the Senate side, that the last time, not this most recent, but the last time in 2020 that Elizabeth Warren tried to do this, she did have a House companion bill that was supported by several Democratic members of the House. So there's at least some initial support that's coming on the House side for this. The big question is there going to be enough support overall, not only to advance this bill, but to pass this bill and get both the Senate and the House to agree on a final piece of legislation that they could send to Joe Biden's desk. I think we are a long ways away from that at a time when, of course, bipartisanship can be rather elusive, and you may have some Democrats who are not necessarily thrilled with this. I should note that there are members of Congress who voluntarily do not trade individual stocks. They just simply don't do it. I've talked to many of them or their staff, and they said, it's just not something that we are going to do, that the member of Congress individually, and these are Republicans and Democrats, just opt out of the system altogether. They all certainly have that right, but there are plenty of examples on the other side, again, both Republicans and Democrats, who very much are sometimes even day trading and making stock trades that are happening every month, every week, even every day.
Yeah. Well, I know as part of your reporting, which everyone should check out, it's available at Insider right now, you looked into some of the recent financial moves of a few different representatives, Senator Burr, Senator Inhofe, and others. Was there anything that you found that raised, obviously not legal concerns, all of this is totally legal, but any ethical concerns or anything like that?
Well, the biggest one and the most notable one, where several members of Congress have kind of gotten crosswise with standard notions of ethics or even potentially the law, it surrounds the COVID-19 pandemic. You had a number of senators, a small number, but still, several who were making very active trades right around the time that the pandemic was becoming a pandemic here in the United States, and major questions being raised as to whether they were acting on information that they were only privy to because they were members of Congress. They were going to special secret hearings that you or I were not able to attend, and then making stock trades in kind of a flurry of action right around February and March of 2020. And there have been members of Congress too. You've mentioned a few, and also too on the Democratic side, most recently Tom Malinowski of New Jersey, who have made trades that have been of companies that have a direct stake in the way that the pandemic is going to go forward, biomedical companies, pharmaceutical companies, medical device companies, and just to name a few. So this is something that has gotten a few members of Congress in trouble. Richard Burr was under federal investigation for this. Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue of Georgia, no longer senators right now, having been booted out of office by voters. They also got wrapped in, and a few others too. So this is not an isolated problem. This is something that has happened not only to several people, but several times over the span of many months.
That'll actually be my final follow-up is Loeffler and Perdue, both drew a lot of negative attention in the press, thanks to the really egregious choices in terms of what they sold, what they bought, and the, I think, very reasonable concerns about what information they might have had access to that we did not, and that they could have been exercising in those decisions. In your talks with representatives or their teams, have you come across anything that makes you think that the fact that they went on to lose their reelection bids, is there any reason to believe that that might have caused some concern among others still in government, that this might be a thing that in the future people might actually vote based on, or that it might influence their evaluation of politicians, these seemingly unethical, if legal, financial decisions?
Quite possibly. And there's no telling where this is all going to land, but I've seen two things. Number one, you have some members of Congress who have changed their habits. I've talked to a couple of offices who have already said, well, look, we are going to put all of the congressman's assets or congresswoman's assets in a blind trust. So they will have no idea what is happening with their financial assets. It's just simply not going to be open to them. They're going to be as clueless as we are. And others who have decided that they're just not going to buy and sell stocks anymore. So again, that's kind of on the voluntary end. When it comes to actually creating a firm hammer that would come down on members who do this, that's going to have to absolutely come not through volunteerism, but through legislation. And that's where Elizabeth Warren's bill comes into play. If this is something that is to advance and go forward, then that very well could change in a major, major fashion the way that members of Congress are able to invest their own personal funds, which would be anathema to some who believe that members of Congress should be able to do this freely as individuals, but definitely music to the ears of many others who feel, not just in Congress, but in the public, who feel that this is just not something that elected officials should be doing because of the information that they get and because of the special interests that have so much business, literally billions upon billions of dollars of business with the federal government directly and members of Congress making decisions that affect their bottom line in a profound way.
Okay. Well, we will certainly be watching to see what happens with Senator Warren's legislation. I'm sure you'll be watching as well. I think I know where this is going, but you never know. Maybe we can be surprised by American politics, and hopefully we'll talk about it in the future. Anyone watching this would like more information about the legislation or the investigation into those representatives that we were alluding to there, Dave's work is available at Insider. Dave Leventhal, as always, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thank you, John.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.